welcome to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perger, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing our examination of where politics and economics and social concerns are going in the wake of the Donald J. Trump ascension to the presidency. That's also upcoming, the president-elect he is. But before we can move on, a South Carolina judge has ruled that Dylann Roof is, in fact, competent to stand trial, which is pretty obvious given that it was clear he knew exactly what he was doing and had been planning to do it for some time. Although I guess when you are clearly 100% guilty of a racist mass murdering spree, you gotta try everything. Jury selection in the case will begin today, and Roof is widely expected to be found guilty. Prosecutors are also seeking the death penalty in this case. Roof's actions, while isolated, are important. And in this era of increased hate crimes, remembering how they can happen is key. While we are constantly and consistently told the biggest threat to America is radical Islam, it's worth noting that since 9/11, the majority of terrorist attacks on U.S. soil have been conducted by white supremacists who have killed double the number of people as those allegedly inspired by Islam. We have the history also of the Ku Klux Klan, which for decades was one of the most powerful institutions in American society, to remind us that white supremacist terrorism is as American as apple pie. So as various neo-Nazi Klan alt-right type individuals come out of the woodwork, we'd be wise to remember the threat posed by radicalized whites. It isn't just Dylann Roof, and it wasn't really surprising that it happened, given America's history. Jill Stein, Green Party candidate for president in the 2016 elections, has raised millions of dollars to launch a recount of election results in Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Wisconsin as questions over the outcome of the elections there have mounted. A number of high-profile computer scientists have raised questions about the outcome because of variances in the number of votes received by Hillary Clinton in areas using paper ballots versus electronic voting machines. The group noted that Hillary Clinton received 7% fewer votes in counties that used electronic voting machines as opposed to paper. And to them, this suggested that perhaps the machines were hacked, and thus an independent review or recount was required to determine what took place. In Wisconsin, for instance, this could mean that she lost something like 30,000 votes, while she lost the election by only 27,000. However, many other analysts have questioned the credibility of this analysis. 538 has advanced an alternative analysis that showed the difference was due to demographics, most likely not hacking. So unless there is a recount, we probably can never really know what happened, and perhaps Jill Stein's effort will provide that chance. But the upshot of the whole thing is how fragile the elections in the country really are. For years, experts have warned that electronic voting machines in this country are extremely susceptible to hacking, which election officials continually brushed off as not credible and that people in the media dismissed as crazy. We know for absolute certain that voter suppression played a big role in the outcome of this election as well. And clearly, when we look at the potential number of voters who were purged from voter rolls in key states, it's well within the margin of victory for Donald Trump, so perhaps it could have changed the outcome. But this, of course, doesn't mean all those people would have voted or even voted against Trump. But again, it's suggestive of bigger issues. From the veracity of electronic voting machines, the differences in how we count votes in various areas, the truth or untruth of exit pollings, to outright voter suppression, there are many issues with American elections that deserve to be examined at greater length and with much more direct data. So while we have no idea if Jill Stein will succeed in her request for a recount, we can say at the very least that now we are going to have a broader discussion about whether or not and how elections in America can be rigged. Donald Trump told us throughout the whole Republican primary that rich people run politics, and with his cabinet appointments, he seems to be proving it. Trump, of course, is an alleged billionaire. And as his Secretary of Education, he's appointed Betsy DeVos, who's part of a family worth just over $5 billion, which, by the way, was a fortune that rests primarily on a pyramid scheme known as Amway. Tells you something about the government there. Wilbur Ross, who the Washington Post says will be Commerce Secretary, is worth $2 billion or so that he made buying distressed assets, something that earned him the nickname the Bankruptcy King. A guy named Harold Hamm is worth $15 billion and could be Secretary of the Interior. And even Steve Bannon, the white nationalist senior White House advisor, is making millions off a stake in the popular TV show Seinfeld. Take a look at that. Todd Ricketts from the billionaire family that owns the Cubs, also is being tipped as a new member of the administration. Mitt Romney is as well, and you may remember him. He's a big-time hedge fund guy worth about $250 million. And the Trump whisperer, a.k.a. Trump's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, is from the billion-dollar Kushner real estate dynasty. So while Trump is saying he's going to drain the swamp, it seems like he's planning on filling it back up with water straight from the 1%. Buckle your seatbelts, people, and prepare for the coming bait and switch. And those were today's talking points, and you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik. In Washington, D.C., I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us.
By Any Means Necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined in this conversation by James Early, the former director of cultural heritage policy at the Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage at the Smithsonian Institution, also a board member of the Institute for Policy Studies. Jennifer Bryant, friend of the show, also an organizer with Cooperation DC, and Josh Harris, former Green Party candidate for mayor in Baltimore and an advocate in that city on a range of issues. Thank you all for joining the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So, yeah, where to start? Obviously, I guess in the post-election and then really the past sort of, for you all to know, week of shows we've really done have been just sort of delving in on a lot of these different post-election realities, what's happening, what's going on, what to expect in different particular areas. So, you know, trying to parse all this, perhaps the best way maybe to start this election, I don't know, is what – What are maybe some of you, we haven't had any of you guys on since the wake of the election. Maybe we'll just start some post-election takeaways. Jennifer Bryant, I'll start with you. Coming out of this Donald Trump victory, I mean, are a lot of people sort of the sky is falling is sort of the feeling that's around. As someone who throughout the whole campaign, you were sort of pointing out some of the problems with both major candidates. How are you feeling in the wake here?
Well, I've been thinking a lot this last week about how the Trump presidency is being framed in the media. I'm an organizer, but I'm also a journalist. And so I'm really interested in the narratives around the election. And so when, you know, we just had Thanksgiving and there's all of these issues in Standing Rock under a Democratic presidency. And so some of the things that I'm seeing about Trump being, you know, Satan, which could potentially come true, but then what does that mean for all of the things that are happening now? What does it mean for all of the people that have been deported over the last 8 years? What does it mean for all of these realities that we see, Ferguson and all of these things that have happened over the last 8 years? I think that it's problematic for me to see the focus be so much on the two parties rather than the issues around the structural issues in our society that kind of transcend party lines.
Yeah, well, I think that's a good point. And James Early, I'll switch to you on this next question, which I think is related. I think it's relevant to me that when I was looking at a lot of the anti-Trump protests that were happening in the wake of it, one of the most unifying chants in those protests that seemed to be emerging spontaneously, and some of them were all whites, and I thought this was quite interesting, was Black Lives Matter. And what I thought there is that, okay, well, everyone is pointing out to the fact that people are angry, they're out in the streets, they're about Trump, and people say, well, this is about nothing, people don't know what's going on, he's going to be the president. But I thought going one level deeper, it seemed that that wasn't really what it was about, but that this is just another expression. We've seen Black Lives Matter. We've seen Fight for 15. We're seeing Standing Rock. We saw some of what happened in the Sanders campaign, that there's more of a continuum here over the past couple years of people maybe not 100% aware of it, but this is what they're doing, I think, sort of opposing the neoliberal direction of the country, and that these protests are just another expression of that. Your thoughts?
I think these protests are a continuation of something that has been happening not only in your country but around the world. I'd like to date back, and I think we all should date back to 2008 with the ethical and financial crisis of capitalism that was so grave that even the mainstream press had to use that terminology. The sky has fallen of shallow analysis that, and I think people are stunned, and many of the progressives and the leftists who call me are just racked with nerves. One Indian America from East India called and said that on my Facebook that, you know, I think I want to leave the country. This is not a democracy. So that the sky of shallow analysis has fallen and people are left in shock. I think the fact that Black Lives Matter continues to come up, let's set aside the individuals who either initiated that or now the broader network of Black Lives Matter for a moment. and see what is the objective, what may be the objective basis of the response of many, many young white and Latino Americans who have seen that this is an unjust system. This is an accumulation of socialization of fairness and justice. It doesn't answer the question, but it can be dismissed. I've always thought that that was a humanistic index. And I think the continued reference, but there is also a sharp political reference. We must keep in mind now putting those individuals, particularly those gay, lesbian women who have been very straightforward about who they are in order for people to get beyond and look at the systemic issues that some of them have been raising, is that they have been targeted. They have been threatened. Giuliani came right out prior to the election and said that this is terrorists. These people, it's a criminalization of social justice movements. And so there are a lot of debates about Black Lives Matter and about individuals and so forth and so on, and those should continue to go on. But let's not lose what the political negotiation of power is about. And finally, I would say, I think we should not look at this as a post-election analysis, but a pre-inaugural analysis. Mm. And the fact of the matter is that various social groups are in motion, in critical motion against what has gone out. It's a fan of critiques and perspectives, but it presents a popular kind of front that progressives and leftists should try to engage, understand, and interact with while looking at the short side of it, but concentrating on what is the political motion against the status quo. And so there are going to be many, many demonstrations, and the state is going to be out in major open, brutal force, as well as they're going to be surveilling. And so we have to, I think, begin to talk about the pre-inaugural moment of political struggle that we have now moved into.
Mm-hmm. And Josh Harris, let me ask you a sort of a slightly different question, a certain wrinkle, but feel free to respond to anything you heard as well. You were running for mayor in Baltimore, very heavily working class, very heavily black city. A lot of people have been looking and pointing to the number of people who didn't vote in this election, especially in areas with those demographics. I know that you were out doing a lot to try to activate a community of people who do feel sort of left out and left behind in the by the two major parties in terms of the type of change they need. And, you know, I've heard some people say that it's not apathy that's driving people in quote unquote inner city America to not vote, but it in some ways is sort of a protest vote of its own. And as someone who was sort of out there in the nitty gritty talking to folks on the day to day, I mean, how do you fall on this? I mean, are people just sort of in despair, or were people sort of trying to send more of a message as well of their feeling of a lack of, I guess you could say, agency in the political process based on the choices they feel they're given at the top ticket level?
Well, there's a couple things I'd like to touch on. But to answer your question specifically, I think that it's really a reflection of what we saw exactly, of people feeling like their votes and their voices don't matter. And so what we saw is that the candidate, though we may not all agree with her, who won the popular vote but yet lost the election. And so people see that, and particularly in low-income communities and working-class African-American communities see that, and they feel like their voices don't matter, so why try? Why should I figure it out? I'm going to have to get up and go to work every day, no matter what, the next day. And really seeing the lack of understanding is being able to separate the national election from the local elections and how that impacts their lives daily. And so there's definitely an education component that has to occur there. There were, I think, a lot more people that turned out in Baltimore. This was the highest turnout we've seen in five or six election cycles for a general election. And so we saw an increase in numbers, although not the numbers that we would like to see, knowing that Baltimore has the highest concentration of unregistered African-American voters in the country, I believe. And so there's still plenty of work to do there on engaging and educating and empowering voters, but really getting them to recognize how those local elections can begin to change their daily lives and positively impact them, and not so much look to the national election to do that, and really that political awareness and understanding on how that plays a role. I'm interested, too, because in a post-election analysis or pre-inauguration analysis, I, too, come from a journalistic background, and so I've been interested to see how the media has really played the oncoming Trump presidency, particularly when we look at the astronomical amount of contradictions that have already come to light, things that he said and now that he's changed his mind on, that he's not going to do, and seeing how the media has somewhat downplayed that into, and, oh, that's just what Trump does, rather than advocating for accountability and responsibility for one's actions that have actually been caught on video and documented in statements. It's just kind of been written off as that's just what we can expect. which is, I think, totally unacceptable. I think from a journalistic perspective, we have to begin to push, and it's our responsibility to hold individuals accountable. This or anyone, and I don't know if there's a level of now deference that's coming in because he is the president-elect, and so they're giving him some wiggle room. The way I like to see much more pressing on those contradictions. There's been so many of them on things that he's even let down those that have voted for him already by contradicting what he said previously. And so it's definitely particularly interesting to evaluate that and see how that plays out, and how it has played out over the last few weeks. So it's been interesting to watch, and I think it's also interesting to see and have people really recognize the problems with our electoral process as a whole. So many people who voted their entire lives didn't know what the Electoral College was, and now they're like, what is this? And figuring out and understanding that the Electoral College did essentially what it's supposed to do, which is put in place to suppress the African-American minority vote. And it was a deal made with the South. And so when you look at the allocation of the votes and how they're given, that is what is designed to do. And that's exactly what we saw this election cycle as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think that's a great point. We're going to stop there for a second. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back with much, much more here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are continuing with our post-election or pre-inaugural analysis of things happening in the wake of the Trump presidency. And we continue to be joined by James Early, who's the former director of cultural heritage policy at the Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage at the Smithsonian Institution. Jennifer Bryant from Cooperation DC, which, as you might imagine, works on building a cooperative economy here in Washington, DC. And Josh Harris, who was the most recent past candidate for mayor for the Green Party in Baltimore and also is an advocate for a number of causes in that city. And I just want to continue because I thought, James, that Josh made a great point there towards the end in terms of the role of the Electoral College and the issue of it doing what it was supposed to do. And I wonder if that's something that in some ways we need a deeper and sharper analysis on, is that people are, you know, is sort of on two levels. One, the whole, well, America, you know, like needs to come together, blah, blah, blah. Like, when was America ever together? But two, like, oh, this is not democratic. This is not democratic. I mean, as if like the people who were writing the Constitution, like that was their number one aim or something.
Well, I think programs like your program, I sit on the board of the Real News Network. I'm a former radio journalist myself way back in the last millennium when for 5 years at WHUR at Howard University, I did a program called 10 Minutes Left, which was left. We have got to bring a better analysis of what is the relationship between a proactive citizenry organizing itself to express its aspirations on a consistent basis and in relationship to people that they send forward as stewards that deal with the big panoramic issues like health, like natural disasters that you cannot deal with on a local level. You can't stop a virus on a local level. You just can't have a voluntary association of citizens who say, let's come together. We're going to stop this plague, or we're going to deal with this cataclysmic environmental crisis that we've entered into. That's why we have the state. That's why the state emerged. Even in a socialist country like Cuba, the same discussion is going on. What is the relationship between a proactive citizenry as the key, as the pivot in relationship to the stewards of government? Because we've had it out of whack, both in terms of capitalistic democratic processes, as well as the question of democracy under socialism. So that I think this is an opportunity to talk about what is the history of the electoral system? What is that sociology? What was its goals? Because so many liberals, progressives, as well as right wingers, don't know that history. So this is one of those moments, and it's a teaching moment. But then we've got to connect that back to what happens on the ground with organized citizenry, including this discussion that looms out there about third parties, which drains off a lot of left activists and some progressives by simply saying the system does not work. It doesn't make a difference. Ross Baraka at the State of the Black World Conference in New Jersey last week pointed out the consequential differences in this bourgeois electoral system. You just can't dismiss it. The real issue is we can't rely on it. So that's something that we've got to work with the public in unraveling the distinction and the intersection of active citizens along with reform, reconstruction of this bourgeois electoral system to our advantage in building the third platform that we need. But you can't just do a pop-up third platform out there and say, well, they're negotiating the military-industrial complex, who's going to get bombed. They're now putting underwater drones. They're looking at China. We don't have to be bothered. That's either, and let many black people say, that's white folks' business. Well, that's my business, because it's going to be soldiers from rural areas and urban areas who can't get jobs, who can't get good education, who go into the military to sustain that. So I think this is an educational moment to look at those two factors.
Well, and Jennifer Bryant, interesting point, and I think Josh pointed this out as well in some of his comments in the last segment. I mean, this sort of local national piece, because I do think that to some degree, I mean, like when you see the only places you really see third parties have success right now, to some degree, limited degree, is on the local level. I think it's easier for people who are like, quote unquote, on the left to be unified around like the minimum wage and public banking, which Josh Harris did quite a bit of education on for people there. It's an important issue you should look into. I know you know about that. I mean, to some degree, and I know you and I off air had some similar conversations about this, sort of like, if it seems like you just kind of came out of nowhere, that's going to count against you. And the importance of not only being grounded in social movement work, but having deeper roots in certain areas is so key to building alternatives. So I want some of your thoughts on this. Also, similarly to Josh as well, I know a lot of the work that you do is also in some of these black communities where, you know, large numbers of people didn't vote. Although in Ward 8 in D.C., 50% of people voted. But it's a whole other issue.
That's true. You know, I live in Ward 8, and there were long lines at the polls, both during early elections and on election day.
Shocking. For people who are not from Washington, D.C. listening to this poll, that is shocking. It's very – even when Obama ran in 08, I think only like 40% of people voted.
Yeah. But, you know, there's so much that needs to happen in terms of third-party electoral strategy and electoral politics. That's not really my primary focus. I'm really looking at building alternative institutions. And I think that we have to find more ways where those two things intersect. Like, for example, in New York, the cooperative movement there on the local level in New York City was really successful in getting the city to allocate over $1 million to support the development of cooperatives. So I think that's an example of the intersections between building parallel institutions and engaging the local government. But I think that we really need to go back to basics and think about how can we get people engaged through local economic projects, through local self-governance outside of electoral politics. So how can we think about, I think, with living in Ward 8, you know, we have one of the highest unemployment rates of any metropolitan area of comparable size. And we really have to think about how can we create jobs for ourselves. And so that's my interest in cooperative economics. And cooperatives don't have to be the only way. There are many strategies that we can use. But cooperatives are a way to get people not just employed, but engaged civically. And I think that that's what we need. We need people that are more civically engaged, people that are more that feel invested in the communities that they live in and feel invested in getting involved in politics locally.
Well, I think that's a good question. Hopefully we'll swing it back around to the cooperative piece as well. I think there's a lot to say. But I think, Josh, that's a great question that I'd like your thoughts on as well, too, or a great point. Because, you know, I feel like a lot of the context around voting and how we talk about it and even how people are analyzing the results is, like, who didn't do what? Like, these people didn't do this, these people didn't do that. As if, like, if all you did – like, I said to someone, so say, like, if everything you did up to Election Day for, like, the past 15 years was, like, only empowering your community – but like you didn't show up and vote on election day, then people were like, oh, well, you can't complain. You can't do anything, blah, 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 as if this is the only form of engagement. And I almost feel like that in and of itself is also an issue. I mean, you see Kaepernick did not vote, but like this guy started a nation worldwide conversation about racism in America. And people are still writing like, well, he didn't vote. So it invalidates everything he did. I mean, it's just sort of a crazy way to look at, you know, quote unquote, democracy and engagement from my perspective. But I don't know what you think about that.
Yeah, no, I think that it's definitely we have to really change how we engage and unengaged electorate and making sure that we're focusing on issues and educating on how those issues impact their daily lives. And so running as a Green, it was an amazing learning experience through my campaign to really see, well, how do we get minority to communities to understand the importance of environmental justice and how it impacts their daily lives. And so knowing that it's not just about reducing carbon footprint, and all these terms we hear, Greens tend to be very educated constituents, and they're high level and they understand the issues very deeply. But when going into everyday working class communities, that tends to be too much, and I don't get it. How does that impact my life? Until you talk about the effect that lead paint and what that did in Baltimore to so many families in Baltimore City, until you talk about the incinerator that's causing high rates of asthma and predominantly African-American and low-income communities in Baltimore City that was fought for and organized against, and what those types of issues mean to everyday people. And so I think that we have to really begin to organize, as was said, organize outside of just the electoral process and get people to understand these are issues that every single day, whether it's about a political campaign or not, are impacting your lives.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that, and I'm one of the biggest critics of the Green Party. There is a lot of work to be done there to really begin to reach everyday average folks where they're at and get them to understand, rather than just condemning folks for being whatever party their party affiliation is. That's not going to work. We have to begin to, it is a messaging and a branding component that goes into it, as well as understanding best practices. There's a lot that I noticed that is not being done when it comes to grassroots organizing and how do we mobilize, build structure and infrastructure to grow a party. A lot of work that needs to be done there, really understanding how we reach folks and meet them where they're at. Because we don't have the ability to do that, we won't be able to grow as a party. And that's just the reality. And that really does start on the local level and not just in the electoral or election year. It extends beyond that, which is why beyond my campaign, we're going to be launching an initiative come December 1st to continue to work for policy solutions. Because, again, my campaign wasn't about me. It's about solutions, and it doesn't matter to me who implements them as long as they're being implemented to move, in our case, Baltimore City forward. So I'm excited to see that our city council is looking at piloting participatory budgeting with a $10 million set aside that was approved on the ballot this November. So it doesn't matter to me if it was me implementing or someone else implementing, as long as we're moving in the direction of more inclusive policy and decision-making process to have people really feel engaged and feel like their voices matter and that their vote counts. That's what I'm concerned about, and that's what we want to continue to push for beyond this election.
No, well, that's a good point. Well, you got 20,000 votes there, so that's a pretty good base to get some things started. Jennifer Bryant.
Well, something that Josh just raised made me think, when we talk about disengaged voters, people that did not come out to vote, I think that we miss a large pool of voters, which are people who are registered to vote, who are politically engaged, but just didn't come out in this election.
Right.
And I think
right.
that there are people like that in every election. But what does that tell us? It tells us that we need real alternatives. I mean, people did not want the Democratic Party. They didn't want the Republican Party. They didn't come out for the Greens. They didn't come out for the Libertarians. And I think that when we talk about people shaming people for not voting, people also shame you when we say, well, let's build an alternative to this. Well, you know, 2020, we need to back the Democratic Party. And it's like, no, at some point we have to stop and really build an alternative.
Mm-hmm. James Early.
I would agree. I think we missed an opportunity, although I think it's the opportunity is still there. We have to change the narrative in a way that illuminates for people what the real sociology of the negotiation of power is about. Holly Neer, I'm almost 70 years old. I guess Holly's somewhere around my age. She's a left cultural activist. On her Facebook page, I thought she had a very interesting non-theoretical proposition. It was a brief exchange in which she said, okay, let's get out of this debate about whether you're voting for or against. What opposition would you rather struggle with in this election? But we are still using term, do you endorse Hillary Clinton? Are you voting for her? I said, no, I'm not voting for her. I'm not endorsing her. But I do want to struggle with what I think is going to be the better, more flexible opposition for the interest that we have. I think the Bernie Sanders campaign, I want to distinguish that from Bernie Sanders, the individual, but he put it out there, just as Josh has just said. This is not about electing me. It's about a permanent organized citizenry and cooperatives and other kinds of things. I think we have to recognize the value of citizens who want to zero in on things like cooperatives and not downplay that or dismiss that, because there are others of us who want to look at the macro system. The two are not opposed, but it's particularly important for those of us who want to look at the systemic nature of U.S. capitalism and the democratic processes that it has to know where these cooperatives, where these women-specific groups are, these gender-specific groups are, these environmental-specific groups are. That's what's the responsibility of stewards, is to have a panoramic view of the views and voices and aspirations, and to try to make sure people are connected in their different discourses to say, okay, now let's look at what may be the common good, the well-being. Who may have to sacrifice? Although you have a great idea, it may be a better idea for all of us if we build this hospital rather than put up this fish pond. But we are using the same language that the system uses to reinforce itself. So I think we have to do that not in artful ways with language, but in talking to people to see if they can see a different angle of entry in the way that power is organized here. So the electorate is a calendar. Citizenship is something that I'm more. What is your vested interest in dealing with this system? Some of you want to reform it. Some of you want to overthrow it. But let's try to take advantage of changing those optics.
Mm-hmm. Josh Harris, get back in here.
Yeah, no, and I think that Jennifer brought up a point that's interesting. She said that we have voters who are registered who did not show up, people who are registered who did not show up to the polls. And I used to also work for Black and Brown People Vote. And one of the conversations we would have when we went around the country doing panels and having these discussions about voter engagement and voter outreach is that just because an individual is registered doesn't mean that they show up to vote. And we know that people only show up to vote because they feel engaged and they understand the process, they understand the part of the process. And we also have had this conversation post my election in reflection and review, knowing that Baltimore's had low turnout in previous elections. And because of the Trump, anti-Trump phenomenon, or people showing up to vote against Trump, it drove voter turnout up in Baltimore City, which actually in many places hurt my campaign, because I had 22,000 votes. And so knowing that people didn't accidentally vote for the Green candidate, these are people who were aware, informed, and engaged, and who knew who I was and made the decision strategically to vote for me, 22,000 people did so. Whereas on the national level, you have people who showed up to vote against Trump and may be completely unaware as to who's running for mayor, who's running for city council, but are going to vote strictly party affiliation and strictly party lines without any questions going into that. And so we have to begin to educate voters on that level, whereas registration is the first step. But now we have to have grassroots organizations that are mobilizing and empowering voters to make informed decisions at the polls rather than just go with what is the norm or comfortable, which in many cases in the African-American community is anything that's Democrat. Even on the campaign trail, without people knowing anything about me, they would say, well, are you Democrat or are you Republican? And if I didn't say Democrat without any counter or response, they'd say, oh, I can't support you. Or if I said I'm not a Democrat, but I'm not a Republican, they'd be like, oh, okay, I get it. But then still really be unaware of anything beyond that process and anything that I stood for, but yet be willing to go to the polls. And so we have to create informed voters. And, yeah, and that is something that has helped the Democratic Party, I think, over years, where we've had uninformed voters showing up to the polls based on a high-level explanation of what the Democratic Party stands for.
Indeed. Well, we're going to have to take a quick break on that, but we're going to come back with more here in our next segment on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we're continuing with a little analysis, perhaps even some predictions about the future in the wake of the Donald Trump presidency and in the wake of the Thanksgiving holiday. So hopefully that tryptophan has worn off. And by this point in the show, you are paying rapt attention to our guest, James Early, who's a former director of cultural heritage policy at the Center for Folklife and Cultural Heritage at the Smithsonian Institution. Jennifer Bryant from Cooperation DC, which, among other things, works on how we build more cooperative economy here in Washington, D.C., part of a national movement on that level. And Josh Harris, who's the most recent past candidate for mayor for the Green Party in Baltimore and an advocate on a number of issues in that city. So I want to just keep rolling because I thought Josh just keeps ending these segments with good points that are like really getting my thoughts going. But, you know, one thing, James, that I thought is very relevant to this in terms of how, quote unquote, Black Americans relate to politics and the sort of Democrat versus Republican, we're all Democrats or we don't vote type of view, which I think is very prevalent. I've dealt with that as a local candidate myself. To some degree, I feel like we aren't actually, as a quote-unquote progressive community, left-wing community, grappling with the impact of not only COINTELPRO, but also the growth of the nonprofit industrial sector, which I think, quite frankly, was deliberate in neutralizing, maybe that's the best term, maybe it's not the best term, the radical Black political leadership in this country for so long. Because I think to some degree, like I always say to people when I'm out organizing, you know, look, you're not the first person to come to this area that has a solution for all these people's problems. And that people who've lived long enough here, I mean, I have people say this to me on the street, like, you got to be careful, they're going to try to kill you. So, and they're not joking. You know, I mean, that this is a historical memory piece and that is, has a heavy impact in terms of how Black America relates to politics today in terms of the quote unquote art of what's possible is the art of what we've seen, what's done when we push beyond what's possible.
I think this is a very important question because I think it has probably come back around of those who run the political classes, both Democrats and Republicans, and in the corporate and in the foundation world, to look at groups like Black Lives Matter as well and Brown Power and Women's Power and Gay, Lesbian, Transgender Power to say, okay, who of these individuals might we bring into the harmonization of the exploitation that this capitalist system does, which is what social democracy tries to do, is let's run this as a normative practice, not as a crisis. We don't always want police in the street trying to hold down things. We want people to feel like they got a stake and they're going along okay. So I think the rise of the NGO sector, that's not totally to dismiss the NGO systems. People want to have access and resources to do some very practical things. They can't eat ideology. They really want to see results of what they're doing. So having those sectors in and of themselves is not the problem. It's once that blunts those who have a more systemic view. But ultimately, I think the responsibility is on left progressives or leftists who have a really systemic critique of this society, who then blame people for taking a small amount of money to develop a cooperative. Are who run for office, but who are not railing against either of the parties. It is on us, the activists, to figure out a more strategic engagement with people, which is not going to be done at some analytical level. Let me sit down with you and tell you exactly how the system works, and then you will see it as clearly as I do. It is in the practice of engagement where people can see both the benefits and the limitations. And as they continue to run up against certain kinds of limitations, they learn themselves. The idea is not to lead people. It is to collaborate with people in leading themselves. So I put the onus back on us. And in this regard, I've been thinking recently, I think Newark is a city we really need to study. We need it. We really need to spend more time with Ross Baraka and Amiri Jr. Baraka. Sitting down, not as mayor per se, but being very much engaged in the intricacies of how the negotiation of power, good, truth, and beautiful in terms of arts, culture, education systems that are set up in that city, as well as housing projects, who's going to deal with juvenile delinquency, single parents, be they women or men, drug issues. How do you bring a more humane, rehabilitative, so that citizens engage in getting themselves out of the situation that the system has put them in? And then, and to be very frank, the killing of Black people, like in Chicago by Black people or in Southeast Washington, you know, there are accumulated historical systemic natures to that. But that in itself does not answer it. We've got to figure out, after losing three or four generations who are in that socialization, that this is how you prove manhood. Increasingly, this is how you prove womanhood. Not to have a horizon beyond 25, 26 years of age, that I have to do this now because there is no tomorrow. They're making analysis. They're using common sense to analyze. And so we've got to get in there with these communities.
No, I think it's a good point. You know, a story I tell a lot. I once had a young cat on the street, man, start crying in a conversation with me. I won't say where it was. This dude is a shot caller in his neighborhood. Young guy, though, like 17, maybe. All his friends, same thing. It's like the middle of the day. I don't think these kids have been to school and like, what is a school, you know? But the questions they were asking me, because I was out there doing some political work, they stopped. They're like, oh, you like the Black Panthers? And then we had like a crazy historical conversation about Malcolm X, the Black Panthers. So they were actually, you know, educated, like, and in tune with it. And it's apropos to my last point. The point was like, well, yeah, didn't they all get killed? And like, isn't that better? But the reason the brother started crying is because he was like, man, I feel like if I tried to get any of these people, his friends have walked away, to kill somebody, I could do it. But when I start talking about like, how do we keep the peace? Nobody wants to listen to me. Like, what is the answer to that question? But I thought it was like such a humanizing moment, because here is your quote unquote super predator. Here is the guy who's out here doing it. He's clearly a community leader. And if you can find a way to help him answer that question, you can maybe start to change some things. It's an interesting piece, but I think it's an important piece. Jennifer, Brian, I don't know if we've said a lot now, so maybe just get in there.
Yeah, I wanted to go back to the point on nonprofits and Black Lives Matter, and even connecting it to the Black Panther Party that you just mentioned. I've levied many critiques about Black Lives Matter, both on the local level in D.C., but also nationally. But I do think that the Movement for Black Lives policy platform, which came out, which was not just Black Lives Matter, the organization, but a broad array of groups, I think it's one of the most radical political documents of our generation. And I think that what it calls for could not just be transformative for Black America, but it's really addressing some of the structural issues of our society. And as we levy critiques against Black Lives Matter, as you said, we should continue those critiques, but we also have to recognize what has come out of it. And I think that that's one of the good things that's come out of it. And I hope that that's something that we hope to organize around locally, thinking about how can we apply this platform on the local level here in Washington, D.C., and what could that mean for our community?
Yeah, that's a good point. And
embracing critiques.
No, embracing critiques.
One of the things is, I'm going to play some ageism as I approach 70, and I have to have these little axioms for myself. Several years, maybe 10 years ago, I started saying, you know what? We've got to learn to struggle for one another before we just immediately struggle against one another. I was learning something about my ultra-leftism. I got the right critique. You're wrong. I'm right. Therefore, you are banished. I'm not going to listen to you anymore. But to start to think, wow, let me struggle this through for an extended period of time. Maybe I will learn something. And we're going to still have some differences. But where do we meet in our actual practice while we deal with these larger idealistic or ideological issues or bigger strategy issues? What can we do at very practical levels? I think you're absolutely right in that assessment of the Black Lives Matter network, that this policy statement, it's also an accessible statement. It's not a lot of rah, 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 breast muscle beating about how bad we are, and, you know, but it's some very practical implications, giving people a broader optic to look at their particular sectoral issues and not just be out there as a fan, not connected to one another. And it's about the system, and where Black people are the pivot. We are the crucible. We are the test case of the foundation of the Republic, Constitutional Republic. Now, that may not be the case in 100 years, but up to now, we still are the test case of all of these ideals in law and constitutions. And it is through the jurisprudence that we have struggled with the system to get certain kinds of progressive reforms that other groups come through and say, that particularity of the Black experience is now a universal that I, as a obese person, I, as a rural person, I, as a gay, transgendered person, or whomever who is being discriminated against, Black people have set not just something for themselves, but they've set an optic which we can all take advantage of. And we've got to instruct our community, because our community tends not to see the pivotal role that we played in the foundation from the point of slavery through its constitution up to this modern period.
Yeah, well, I think it's a good point. And I should just note really briefly, you know, we had M. Adams and Michaela Brown out of Baltimore, who I'm sure Josh knows, on this show about the Movement for Black Lives Policy Platform. They both helped write it. And just to state it, because I think it's worth stating, I said some similar things to them. And M's response was, well, this absolutely can only be seen as an anti-capitalist document. And if you're looking at it any other way, then you obviously haven't read it correctly. And I thought that was one of the things that was really just unbelievable, is you read through the whole thing, and it's such just a damning critique of, right. Or if I may, a ruthless criticism of all that exists. A little Karl Marx for you there in this morning. But Josh Harris, a lot has been said in the past like 5 or 6 minutes, so I just want to bring you back in on this since your ending of the last segment kicked off this line of thought.
Yeah, no, I think that there's a lot of great points brought up, and particularly when you look at the left, I think that one of the problems, and I think that James brought it up, is that we see people who are very firm in their beliefs and very educated and aware, and so because of that, we see a lack of collaboration. It has to change if we're going to organize collectively as a movement to really begin to see real systematic changes, and we have to begin to collaborate more. And I think we're seeing it more now with a lot of the younger organizations that are coming in, who it's not necessarily they're willing to set aside the name of their organization or their name to really work together and get things done. And that's great progress, and I think that's something that we're going to have to continue to work on, especially on the local level, and seeing so many organizations who are doing similar or the same work unwilling or not working together, I think has really hurt the progressive movement, and that's something that has to begin to change, and that I'm seeing changes in the last few years, where I've seen a larger increase in collaboration, if you will, and that willingness to set differences aside for what do we have in common and what can we work together on collectively, because that's where the real organizing and building infrastructure and building capacity for a movement that can really overturn or change a system will come in play, the more collaborations that we see.
Jennifer.
You know, just on the point of collaboration, and I'd also love to hear your thoughts on this, James, but in this pre-inaugural moment, we're hearing lots of calls for unity. And
UNITY.
But, you know, and I've been struggling with this personally, just in terms of what our points of unity are. And you see folks that are now reaching their hands out to the Republicans to form, you know, relationships with them and points of unity with them. But then they're also trying to
Elizabeth
pull
Warren.
In.
Sorry.
But then they're at the same time trying to, you know, also engage the, you know, progressives. And so it just seems like I'm trying to really reconcile that, because we do have to form a united front against Trump. But I'm just trying to figure out what the terms of that united front will be.
Right. Well, what's the basis of it? Because I think this is a great question, James, because I've been struggling with people on this, because I said, look, you know, I can understand how you want to say, well, if we get some infrastructure, let's get some infrastructure. We could get this, we could get that. But to me, that is the easiest way Donald Trump will get reelected in 2020, because he'll be able to say like what he said was true, that like Washington was gridlocked. I came in, I broke it up. I got rid of all the clubby stuff. We, you know, removed sectarianism to some degree. I worked with both sides. I gave people jobs. I mean, to some degree, the Democrats not trying to sort of do a replay of what the Republicans did, which they can't fully do under Obama. I don't know. To me, it almost seems like they're the Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Tulsi Gabbard, sort of like, let's work together on some issues, but we're opposed to racism. I mean, well, okay, it's one thing to be opposed to racism, but if you hand this guy victories over the, you know, big issues that people care about, it's only going to strengthen his brand and his narrative.
Well, it's going to be a protracted process. You'll be my age, maybe before you can say, wow, look at what accumulated over the last 10, 15 years. Because we started at a particular moment. It won't be in one fell swoop. So here's some my practical indices for myself, and I certainly would advise others to consider it. Defensive unity. There is a threat against immigrants. There's a threat against black people. It's already going on in raising the police department to a special kind of citizenry that can stop, detain, and kill you without any questions. They are not public servants any longer, that they are telling you that you must submit to them. So that's one thing in the black community we've got to defend. We've got to work with immigrants who, across the ideological spectrum, the majority of them are concerned about their immigration status, and we have to have a vantage point on that. I think we have to be less romantic and also put some critique on the elites in Mexico and in Central America, yeah, where they're coming from, because the elites are living very, very well there. They're not providing even bourgeois opportunities in their capitalist systems for people to work. And so we have unnatural migrations of people fleeing to where the economic engine is in the north, which tends to be characteristic in the world except on the continent of Africa, where South Africa is the most developed economy, although Nigeria is the largest economy, but it's the most fragmentized country. So defensive unity there. we have got to look at the sociology of power within these parties at local levels as well as national levels. And I'll just quickly reference one point on the national level. We see a struggle going on in the Republican Party. We've got to see where the so-called moderates are, who are honest moderates. We've got to exploit that, but particularly within the Democratic Party. So now you have the status quo, which includes a lot of members of the Black Caucus, not all of the members of the Black Caucus, and certainly the right character of the Congressional Black Caucus PAC, which is different than the Congressional Black Caucus. We've got to get in there and help exacerbate those contradictions so that we need to be meeting with Ellison, not to say, how can we support you? Here's what we want to be supported. And we recognize certain things in your platform, particularly as hammered out in the primary. It was what it is. It's the most progressive marker that has come up. Would I have preferred a more progressive marker? Yes. But what actually came out of the negotiation, the fight over power, who was going to be able to execute a platform, that's what came out. We've got to push that and push beyond that. So there are a number of those kinds of mapping of the actual sociology of power and not letting ideology be a substitute for that, but letting ideology inform that. Because finally, if ideology is a substitute for it, we'll say none of this is really going to get us where we want to go. The way we get to utopia is you step into reality. You don't step around it or over it or look at it as an idea. We have to work through the actual circumstance to get to the impossible.
Well, there is a lot to discuss in that if we're talking about how do we breach the impossible. So we're going to have to bring on all three of these guests many more times. So you should continue to listen every day, Monday through Friday, to By Any Means Necessary here on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. Special thanks to Josh Harris, Jennifer Bryan, and James Early for joining the show today. That's going to do it for our show today. But as always, again, we're here Monday through Friday on By Any Means Necessary. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. See you next time.
By any means necessary.